You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician. Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 242 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
I am great. For the first time, I'm recording this podcast through a brand new mic and a brand new audio interface, which has been a lot of fun. Not just because it's fun to record podcasts, but because I was, you know, recording music with this stuff too.
And it also created quite the fun of us trying to get this up and running as you had to figure out how to route the audio back to your ears.
Yeah, it should always take us 40 minutes to figure out how to set up a podcast.
Exactly. Because, you know, we've only done, this is only episode 242. By episode 300, we'll be in a groove.
Yeah. We'll have it dialed in. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Today, we're going to be talking about five things you need to know about mastering that have nothing to do with audio engineering. But before we get to that, there was a couple items. I forgot to mention on the last episode of the podcast that I had just been to Germany and Austria. And while I was there, I got to see a show at the place where the Beatles first started in Hamburg.
Nice.
And I also, in Austria, went to Mozart's apartment where he wrote The Marriage of Figaro and some other piano concertos. And it was pretty cool to have those, you know, historical music experiences.
Did you feel like you left both of those places a genius through osmosis? Or did you not feel that because you went in as a genius and you were fine?
Yeah, exactly. No, what was interesting with the Beatles thing, you know, that place is a total dive and it's probably not much different. It was when, you know, from when they played there. What I left with was the idea of encouragement and hope for all artists out there who are in the trenches, because, you know, that's exactly what the Beatles did there. They just played. I think it was up to like 6 hours a day, might have been more. There was a whole like plaque on the wall and a bunch of information and pictures from there. And it looked like, in most cases, just the crappy gigs that people play.
Yeah, well, I mean, weren't they playing basically for like drunken soldiers? I mean, not soldiers, drunken seamen?
Sailors. Sailors and with, in a lot of cases, a lot of prostitutes as well, because that whole region was like a bunch of sailors and... Yeah, not your music going crowd.
Wasn't a listening venue.
Yeah, so it was just interesting to be there. It reminded me of the Ash Street Saloon that used to be here in Portland. Chris would know what I'm talking about.
It paints a very vivid picture and smell.
But the one thing that was interesting about being at Mozart's apartment is you're there and all the views from the window pretty much unchanged from when he lived there. The buildings are still the same. They've, you know, gone through some possible renovations, but in all reality, outside of a few electrical wires, you don't really see anything different, except for one window. There's a store across the street, and I think it was a clothing store, but it just had this giant sign that you could see from the window that said Indie. I just thought it was hilarious. It was meant to be. Mozart had an independent spirit.
Yeah. But for that whole, you know, being paid by royalty. But I guess that's
Except
how you
he
got,
took it to the people.
Yeah, that's how you got paid back then.
Yeah, but he preferred to take it to the people directly and the commoners.
This is true. That,
they were more fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, those were fun experiences. It's always nice to have some sort of historical music experience to get your imagination rolling, kind of feel like you're stepping into somebody's life for a moment before you have to go back to your own.
Yeah, and the whole reason you were over there was because there was a huge music festival happening, right?
Yeah, in Germany, there's Reeperbahn, which is a big music festival that happens in the same area where that club, the Beatles, were at, which it was one of the venues for this music festival. So, good times. We don't have any listener feedback today, so I pulled in a news item that is breaking that's probably going to make a lot of people pretty upset.
I can't wait to hear it.
We're going to talk about that right now, then we'll get to the mastering subject matter for the show. The headline from Digital Music News says, "Want a juicy promotion on Spotify? Now you can pay for that." So to be clear, Spotify's had an ad platform for a while, and you can create Spotify audio ads through our ad platform at show.co. And, you know, those are traditional advertising slots where for people that don't pay for the service, you know, ad-supported listeners, you can get your ad in front of them. So that's something that we've been pretty used to for a lot of these platforms. Whether or not you could easily get an ad for your music is another story. But we're used to that. This might be the first time where a platform has allowed people to pay for specific placement. And I know it's going to anger a lot of people. So what they're testing apparently is, do you know what the name of the card is that pops up when you open Spotify? You got one with your release with Dayton.
I did, and I forget what it's called, but it's basically like when you turn your phone on and you look at the Spotify app, there's like some sort of screen or card there that says, you know, the equivalent of like, hey, check out the new track by Chris Robley and Date Night or whatever. So links you right to the song.
Yeah, it takes over your screen. So you either have to close it out or click to go to the music. You have no other options.
Oh, you know what? It just occurred to me. Is it called a canvas?
No, canvas is something
different. It's a
different
thing. Okay.
Canvas is that video that I personally find incredibly annoying.
Oh, I love those things.
That repeats. I turned it off on mine because I have my phone up on my dashboard when I'm driving, and when that's on, it makes it look like I'm watching video while I drive down the road, right. And I don't want to get pulled over because a cop, if I drove by, would see it and go, he's sitting there watching video as he drives down the road. It's also pretty distracting because it's only like 15 seconds.
I think it's less. I think it's like 8 seconds and it loops.
And it keeps looping. So I find it irritating. And also the interface changes. Anyway,
interrupt the news story and have a different news story in the middle of it, it's looking like they're going to expand and open that feature up to way more artists. I don't know if it's going to be open to everyone with a Spotify for Artists account, but it's seeming like it's moving in that direction.
Yeah. Have fun Spotify screening all those videos, making sure they're appropriate. So it's apparently Spotify is testing the ability to let labels and managers buy that placement of that card that you see when you first log into Spotify. And the thing that will make some people upset is just the fact that it's like, here we go again. The people that have the money take control of the platform. Or that the idea that this is some sort of open playing field that Spotify has sort of painted the picture of, hey, it's just our editorial staff finding new releases or pushing new releases that you like. Suddenly, the opportunities for someone to get music featured by just the artist they like might be diminishing. Now, the article says that Spotify is saying it would be limited to only promoting it to people that already like that artist. So basically, it just guarantees the fact that if you're a fan of Small Town Poets or Chris Robley, when you open up your app, you will absolutely see that. But I have mixed feelings over it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm pretty mixed too. I mean, the kind of the realist in me thinks, well, you know, this is maybe more transparently transactional, but there's an element of that even in the sort of behind the scenes promo decisions of all these digital platforms anyways. You know, if you see whoever, Beyonce, or even if it's a smaller like niche genre, you know, there's always people that are going to get the prime real estate on these services. And there's, it might not be so transactional, but there's muscle behind those decisions. You know, there's publicists or the, you know, the promo wing of the distributors working on behalf. So there's always some larger machinery at play. And this just feels like, well, if I know it's just money, it almost makes things simpler. I can just pay you $15 or $500 or whatever it is and guarantee that my little card goes to all my followers, which, yeah. So that's that's maybe the good side of it. The bad side of it's, yeah, maybe the obvious concern of like, oh God, they're going to be paying people to reach their own listeners on this platform that, you know,
we already have to do it on Facebook.
Right. So another way in which you're distanced from reaching your own people.
Yeah. To me, it's sort of the jury's still out. It's like, if this is affordable, then great. But if it's like, hey, you can reach your listeners and it's, you know, $20 per 100 listeners or $100 per 100 listeners, I don't know. If it gets really expensive, then it starts to feel like they're just trying to get us to figure out their revenue problem. I mean, the thing is, Spotify does have a revenue problem.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have to try these things in order to increase revenue. I just don't think it's going to do it enough where it makes sense. Enough where it's like, that really helps and maybe just taints the platform. The other thing why I have mixed feelings about is because they make such a big deal about third-party playlist owners not charging for placement on their playlist.
Right.
So it seems a little hypocritical, even though they can say it's our platform, but that playlister can say, hey, I've built up a reputation of being a good curator. This is my expression, my playlist and my playlist brand. I've done a lot of work to build it up. I should be able to do it with it what I want. So it's just that tension. And, you know, to me, it's stuff like this is going to continue to happen as we still are at the beginning of how these platforms work and make money in the long haul. Apple and Amazon do it in other ways. They make money from, Amazon makes from selling vacuum cleaners or
well, yeah,
books or TVs.
And I don't know how directly this new development with Spotify conflicts with something else that they've made kind of like an initiative about, like, you know, using their direct submission tool within Spotify for artists to get your newest music into the release radar, algorithmic playlist, you know, ecosystem of all your listeners. So that was one thing that they were really driving. And now it's like, okay, but you could also pay us to get the same kind of message to the exact same people, because it sounds like in both cases, it's only your followers who are going to be followers or listeners, yeah. I suppose. So maybe this new thing will reach slightly more people, but I don't know.
It seems like there would have to be a level of guarantee.
Yeah. In a way, it feels like you're paying to kind of like retread some steps that you've already taken by trying to get your song into release radar.
Well, I'm curious to hear what you out there listening, what you think. You can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. Does Spotify allowing people paid placement make you angry, happy? I mean, we don't know how they would roll it out yet. I mean, if it was an auction and the highest bidder wins, is that something that, you know, would change your opinion or not? Because even though you can only target maybe people that are your fans, they're fans of a lot of bands. So who's going to get that card when they open up their app on Friday, mm-hmm. when new music comes out? That's the thing. It's like
the auction.
Yeah. So you're fighting for space and then you're being outbid by people who are just throwing funny money at it because they think that's going to break their latest artist. Anyway, it's new and developing, but just curious to hear what people think. Again, 360-524-2209. Or podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. All right. Today we are going to be discussing five things you need to know about mastering that have nothing to do with audio engineering. And Chris, you brought up this idea. So why don't you give a little background about what we mean by not having anything to do with audio engineering?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously mastering is an audio engineering process, so it'll have something to do with that. But what I really meant is, I am one of the least technical music makers in the world. Like, I have almost zero understanding of frequencies and EQ and all this. Like, I have friends that are like, oh, cut 2 dB in the 2K hertz range. I mean, I might just be speaking complete nonsense right now, because when they say those things, I have a better understanding of Greek than I would have of whatever they're saying to me. So anyways, I'm an idiot when it comes to technical terminology with sound, but there's still a lot of really important information about mastering I think we could share that isn't technical and that is really important for artists to understand as they're nearing the end of their kind of creative music making process and getting ready for distribution. So that's sort of what I wanted to hit upon.
Yeah. And it's been a while since we've had a mastering engineer on the podcast. I mean, years really. And a lot of things have changed with options out there and lots of different people talking about mastering in a way that I don't think adds any clarity to it. So our five things here, let's start with number one, number one is, what is it at a high level?
Yeah. Okay. So this is, mastering is basically the last creative step in the music making process. And I think maybe people would argue about whether it's creative or not. I think it is, because it's still, you're asking oftentimes a human being, but sometimes a very ingenious computer system to listen to your music and then make decisions about it. And that would take the form of sort of sweet, they call it sweetening the audio. You're changing subtle, you know, making subtle changes to the final mix of your song to bring out whatever qualities you want to enhance and maybe limiting problem areas. So it could be you want a little bit more kick in the bass and a little more clarity in the top end, or, you know, any of those sorts of decisions can be made in the mastering process. There's also compression and limiting, which, you know, can sort of squash the dynamic range of your song so that you can raise the volume and it can, you know, be louder, and which is people often mistake is more exciting, but sometimes is more exciting. Anyway, so yeah, it's a process of taking a mix and getting it ready for consumption on streaming platforms or on CD or vinyl. That's basically what it is.
Yeah, I would say that when you're using Pro Tools or GarageBand or whatever software you use to record, whether it's in a studio or at home, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it's a very experienced engineer who's been recording records forever, or you're a new home engineer just trying to figure things out. Every song you record, you're not recording things at the exact same levels. So this takes all that into account, especially if you're making an album that, hey, the track that we recorded yesterday, everything wasn't as loud as how we recorded today, or just individual things shift and change. The drums are boomier on this track and not this track. So there's a lot of that kind of cleanup and consistency to make things work together that mastering does. Also, I think it's important to talk about in this, you know, what is it, that all mastering is not created equal. Even extremely qualified professional mastering engineers do not all approach it the same way. And so it's important for you to get a sense for what it is. And then as you're talking to, whether it be an engineer or you're using automated mastering, that you know what results you might be getting based on what previous projects, if it's a person that they've done, or if it's automated thing, some of the options that are in the software. You know, for us, Small Town Poets, the last full-length album we did, we used a mastering engineer, and the words the band was saying after hearing the masters was, this is the most natural-sounding album we've done, and they enjoyed the mastering because of that. Hmm. Then the single that we just released, that like single EP we released, we used somebody else, and I think a lot of us were in agreement that it was, out of everything we've ever done, the most we've heard a mastering engineer make it sound better. Not in the mix sucked and we got to fix things, but like, oh, wow, I can really see how this great sounding mix became a whole lot better. And it really felt like the guy just nailed it. We didn't even give any revisions. We just thought he nailed it. And so there's a very different approaches that people have, like where you may be wanting, I want a natural sound, or I want it to be a really pop and heavy hitting, you know, in your ears kind of sound, or I want, you know, it to be really mellow and lots of dynamic range. And so there's lots of things to consider, because they can do a lot of things that make your music sound totally different.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I mean, when I was describing what it was in the first place, I mentioned kind of balancing the frequencies across a single song. And then you'd mentioned sort of balancing volumes and kind of the presence of each song from song to song on an album. Another part of that is also sequencing and transition. So if, you know, you have an album where you want a couple songs to crossfade, or you need to leave 4.5 seconds of space between the tracks, all that stuff gets done during mastering as well. But to jump into our second point, mastering isn't only valuable when you're making an album and you need to balance a bunch of songs together. It's also really necessary for singles, because now we're in this, you know, digital music landscape where you don't want to be the one artist on a playlist who, when it gets to your song, suddenly is way quieter than the rest, or is like way muddier than the rest of the songs on that playlist. You really have to think about mastering as maybe not artistically conforming, but conforming to certain kinds of volume and EQ trends that will make your music live amongst all the other songs and singles that are getting used in a number of different ways in the digital environment.
You, like you mentioned, it's a very important thing. Like if you drop your track in with a bunch of other songs that, you know, have all been mastered and mixed by other people, you want to make sure that you're at least in the ballpark. Otherwise, it can drop considerably. Or one thing that can come up in the mastering process is that you mixed it too hot and you've really pushed things too far and not left a lot of room for the mastering engineer or the software to do any work for you. So that's something that's also worth considering. But yes, as a single, even for singles, you need to go through this process.
Yeah. And one other thing, this is probably more related to the first topic we mentioned, but like, you know, when you've recorded a song and it hasn't been mastered yet, like sometimes you might listen to it on your car for reference or something, and the lows kick in and suddenly your car speakers shake in a really unpleasant way, or the highs are you know, the guitar solo comes in or something, or the synth and it's way too hot and high. Like, so mastering can tame a lot of that stuff too, so that when, again, if your song is sitting in a playlist, it's not like, oh, what the hell is that?
At least not for the audio signal level.
Right.
You know, it's funny, back in the day when Small Town Poets was on a label, one of their big marketing strategies was to create these sampler CDs and give away for free at colleges, because, you know, college students are typically broke and don't have money to buy CDs in a CD world. And that strategy worked really well. And one of the big compilations they made, our people mastered it, our label, but it had some other labels' music on it as well. And when you got to our track, it was considerably quieter. And I'm like, what the crap happened here? We made this CD, and they still have us like, you had to turn the knob up a little bit for our song, because and if you're in a car listening at a normal level, it was easy to just let our song kind of go by as noise, because you realize, oh, I'm not quite hearing it like I was. It was interesting.
Well, there's whole industry-wide conversations that have been happening for almost two decades now at this point about loudness and compression and mastering, because just because your song was quieter doesn't mean it sounds worse. It actually might sound a lot better, because if you simply just turn the volume on your stereo up, your song might have more expression and dynamic range and all this stuff. But we also have to deal with reality, and we live in a world where when something is noticeably quieter compared to what's sitting around it on a playlist or on a compilation CD, in your case, like, there's that perception that it's less exciting and less quality simply because it's lower volume, which I know to the audiophiles probably is nonsense, but this is just typical consumer behavior, consumer perceptions, I guess.
Yes, exactly. All right, we move on to number three.
Let's do it. Oh, you kind of mentioned this, but number three, I said, it won't make crap sound great. It it can make good mixes sound bad, but if done right, mastering can make great mixes even better. And I think you mentioned that about your recent experience where you got it back and you're like, oh, this is way better, even though we started good and we got something better.
I think why mastering is such a mystery to a lot of artists is that when you go through the mixing process, it seems like what you're trying to listen for is pretty obvious. You know, your overall sound, it's like, hey, this is what I thought we'd get. Like, how loud are the drums, bass, guitars, vocals, and all that kind of balancing stuff amongst itself. And, you know, it varies depending on the style of your music you're doing as well. When you go through the mastering process, it can be like, I don't know what I'm listening for anymore. But once you get a sense for going through the process a few times, you can really start to latch on to what's happening and what to be listening for, and the things that it can do to make it better and the things that it can do to make it worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're almost touching on the fourth part of our discussion, which was brace yourself for the mystery. Because it can be when you're getting towards the end of this creative process, like, you know, like you say, you know exactly what you're listening for on a mix. by the time the mix is done, your ears are exhausted. You've lost perspective on what's magical or not about your songs. And then suddenly you have to enter this mastering process, which is very mysterious to most of us in terms, you know, on a technical level. And when you are comparing it to the mix, you compare a master to a mix, it's really confusing because there's always trade-offs and sacrifices. And it might be that suddenly the vocals are more present and clear and you love that. But in order to do that, the mastering engineer had to take some excitement out of the drums or something like that. So, you know, there's very rarely have I ever heard something come back and been like, in every possible way, this is better. And I'm gung-ho excited about this. Let's go. Another difficult thing about comparing the master to other versions of the master or to the original mixes is the volumes are off. I mean, part of mastering is usually raising the volume. So suddenly there's a very, you have to make some adjustments to get any kind of apples to apples sort of comparison based on that. So there's just a whole lot of mystery and a whole lot of confusion about how to compare the results of the mastering. And then worst of all is that you just want this stuff to be done and out there and you don't care. You wish you cared. You're so tired. Who gives a damn? Let's put the thing out. So brace yourself for all of that. It's confusion and exhaustion and mystery.
Yeah. So that was number four, brace yourself for the mystery. And I agree. One of the things I do to help with what you were talking about, the volumes being different, is a key issue when you are trying to compare the original mix to the mastered track, that if you are just like listening in an audio player like iTunes or something like that, whatever you listen to, if you don't adjust for the volumes, there'll be some perceptions that are wrong just based on that it's louder. So what I typically do is I'll open up them both tracks in something like QuickTime, where each track has its own little window, and then I can adjust the volume. So the volume level is equal to what I'm hearing, and then I compare it back and forth. I mean, you could drop them into GarageBand or something or Pro Tools and just adjust the volumes on the track so the perception of the volume is the same.
You have exactly described my process. I use QuickTime. I do exactly the same thing. I try to adjust for the volumes. And then you can toggle back and forth. If you open them as, you know, separate QuickTime players, you can toggle back and forth in this way where as soon as you click the other one, you know, it mutes
playing
the one you're leaving and go back and forth.
Yep, that's what I do normally to check it out and compare. There's EQ, what you also mentioned is something that I experienced the very first time I did a professional album with Small Town Poets. We got the mixes, we were all excited, and when we got the masters, I'm like, did they remix this? Because it sounded like in some places they'd brought the guitars back, but it was just that they were a little on the bright side in the mix, and some adjustments they made shaved just a little bit of that brightness off. And so it felt like they pushed them back in the mix, which they didn't. It just, they took that, some of those frequencies that were cutting through the mix stronger out. So there's things like that that can happen. The thing that happened on our track that we just released was that there was this really cool widening of the space in the middle. And that sounds really stupid and hard to explain, but it really felt like it added some space in there, and very perceptible. If you were listening to them both back and forth and listening very, you know, listening closely, you could hear that. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. But it wasn't overboard. It wasn't like some of those plugins you can use that make it sound like it's a million miles wide and lose all its depth. But yeah, so there's just stuff like that that can happen that can be amazing, or it can be like some trade-offs. Like, I liked this in the mix, but in order to master it, we're going to have to deal with this.
The problem I always have with mastering is that even when everything is good, it's still frustrating to me. So the situation I'm in right now is that the same engineer did two different versions, two different mastered versions of my new album. And I listen back and forth, and one of them is louder and brighter and clearer. The other one is quieter, but has a lot of body and warmth and maybe a little lack of clarity or squishiness compared to the other one. But I was having a hard time deciding what was more important for this music. So I sent it to two people that are in the band that helped me make the record. And one of them liked the louder, clearer one, and the other one liked the softer, more full-bodied one. And then I'm still like, what the hell? There's no right answer. Like, I tried to get someone's opinion, and I'm still stuck in the exact same situation I'm in now. So the guy who mixed the album said, the good news is they both sound good. So no matter what you choose, you're fine, which it puts me back in that place where I was saying before, like, oh, I'm just sick of this. Like, let's just be done with it. Like, almost like just flip a coin. But yeah, I'm confused.
I've got a funny mastering story that relates to this, just the confusion aspect. For one of our Christmas records, we were trying to figure out who was going to master it. And we picked this guy and we got back the first pass. And we realized it was the same guy who had mastered one of the last label album for Small Town Poets. It was like 10 years prior, though, which we all agreed was the worst mastering job on any of our albums. And we're like, so what we're saying is that we picked the guy who we think mastered the worst sounding Small Town Poets record. I'm like, yes, it looks like that's what we did do.
Well...
But it turned out good. He had learned a lot in 10 years, but we did have a little bit more back and forth than we had on any other mastering job.
Yeah, well, we may have already said something like this, but mastering can also bring out the worst in a mix. And I made an album which did quite well. It's a good album, but part of the foundation of the record was double-tracked acoustic guitars and doubled vocals. So there was just a lot of phasing sorts of issues, which I didn't think were issues when we were mixing, creating and mixing the music. But when it went to mastering, it suddenly sounded pretty phasey. And a friend of mine was like, this is a terrible mastering job. Like it got really phasey. And so I brought it up with the mastering engineer, and he was like, nope, those are your mixes. Go back and listen. So I did. And I was like, oh, this is an issue where like I've handed something to the mastering engineer that he really can't fix. And no matter what he does to improve other things, it's just going to end up a little phasier. And so I said, fine, this will just be a phasey album.
There yeah. You go.
And it did fine. The album did fine. So obviously no one cared.
See, at the end, nobody cares.
That's the moral of this whole story. Nobody cares.
Number five, the various ways mastering can be used these days, has changed a little bit. And this comes in with like, especially with the automated mastering services that are out there. So a lot of people use them to test mixes, like what you were talking about, to see if there's an issue with the mix. Mm-hmm. So, I've seen some engineers do that a lot, and it's not like they're going to say, oh, this is the master track, but they're looking for some issues that might pop up in the mastering process. So that's something that's interesting, that it kind of gives you a preview. And if there's something that needs to be adjusted in the mix with how like compression or limiting might impact the overall balance of certain instruments and such. Or if your mix is too hot, that's another good way that some of the automated services can help you identify. Like one of them to me gave me a warning recently saying that the mix was too hot and it might have a problem.
Oh, interesting. It's cool that it did that. Well, yeah. And CD Baby has a partnership with a service called Cloud Bounce, which provides nearly instant audio mastering. It's automated. Stuff sounds really good, and it's perfect for, I think, not just reference masters, like to test mixes, like you're saying, but also when it comes down to releasing singles, and if you're on this schedule of frequent releases, like you're probably not going to hire a human audio engineer every single time you put out a single, especially if it's monthly or weekly, because that can add up. But a service like Cloud Bounce is perfect. And then when it's time to maybe put all those songs together on an album, then you hire the human to give it the extra touch. But Cloud Bounce is automated service. I've used, I think, 3 times now. And every time I have no complaints, I'm like, this sounds better. I'm going to put it out. And then again, when it comes time to put the album out, that's when I hire the human.
That's typically what I've been doing as well. So for this EP EP that we did, which is really the same song four times, but different versions of it. For the main official release, we hired a human. And for the three subsequent alternate versions, we used automated mastering. And it came out great. They all fit well together volume-wise and balance-wise. It was pretty good. It was clear the official mix sounded better, but the other stuff was good enough. And for the price point, it was, you know, what we needed it to do. That's like you're saying, when you start releasing more stuff, it becomes cost prohibitive to have a human do it every time. But for all of our single releases before that one, we had just been using automated services. And yeah, you can try out Cloud Bounce right inside your CD Baby account at cdbaby.com. You don't have to distribute anything to go there and try it out. And you can pick up some free show.co marketing tools while you're in there. Yeah, so there's lots of ways you can use it. And I do like the ability with some of them to toggle, like, this is what it'd sound like if it's really loud or medium or soft, and find that kind of balance point of where this particular mix needs to be.
Yeah, totally. One other consideration on this point about various ways mastering can be used is you got to think about the end delivery format or medium. Is it a digital release that's going to be on a CD and or streaming and download services, or are you doing vinyl? Because I'm pretty sure in most cases you need a separate mastered version for vinyl. So if you think one day you're going to do vinyl, or if you know you're going to do it when you release new music, you're probably going to want to go with a mastering engineer who can do both. There's a guy named Adam at a place called Telegraph in Portland, Oregon that I use. And I'm not doing vinyl this time around, but he's totally set up to just make it part of his process. So he delivers 16-bit, 24-bit, you know, he can do the vinyl thing too. So keep that in mind. And then we had a bonus point, which is don't forget to budget for it. And I think that's both money and time, because if you go with a human being, a lot of these mastering engineers are booked up weeks and weeks and weeks out. So, you know, again, at the end of the creative process, we're like itching to just put it out. And then amongst all this mystery and confusion about mastering, there's also an enormous wait time a lot of times for a human. So another benefit with automated mastering is no wait time, which is particularly useful if you're putting out a song every month or every other week or something like that. But just make sure when you're budgeting to record and budgeting to manufacture CDs and whatever else that you're saving money for human mastering if it's a big release.
That was my bonus point, number six. Even though we said five, you came up with the five, and my last point was, hey, make sure you budget for this, because 9 times out of 10, when I'm talking to an artist, it's like in that process of like, I'm trying to get this album done, they say, I didn't budget for mastering. We blew the budget and I forgot to leave money aside for the mastering process. So that's something you got to do and remember. And it can be a variety of fee ranges depending on who you're using. But typically, you probably need to budget, if you're going to have a human do it, anywhere from $50 to $100 a song.
Sounds about right. unless you're like me and you called Bob Ludwig at Gateway, because I live nearby, for anyone that...
Your neighbors.
We're basically neighbors. I've never met the dude. Talked to his wife, I believe. She's very kind. Gave me a quote, and I was like, oh, now I see why Madonna and Daft Punk and the most famous musicians in the world use you, because you're amazing and you charge what you're worth. I will not master with you. That was for my previous record, but it was amazing to just, they were very warm and inviting and, you know, accepting, but not in my indie budget.
You don't remember what it was?
I don't. And I feel like I probably shouldn't even say in case I'm way off, but I think it was between like $2,500 and $4,500 for the album. Of 10 songs.
That sounds about right. I know that when we did one of the Small Town Poets albums, we contacted someone in Nashville that was similar status as Bob Ludwig, maybe not as known, but had worked on same type of very high profile albums, but also knew of us because he was in Nashville and you bump into everybody. And he quoted something like 2,500 to 4,000 or something like that.
And I think the higher number I'm remembering was for Bob, but he has, you know, other people that he trusts that work out of his studio, and the lower range was probably for them. So it's almost like one time this is not related to mastering, but one time I was going to the UK and I thought, I wonder if Abbey Road will let you come in for like a couple hours in between sessions or whatever. And they do. And they wrote me back and they said, you know, here's the price for an hour or 2 hours or whatever it was. And here's the price if you want us to actually like unlock our mic cabinet and use the gear. And like, here's the price if you want to use the piano. And I was like, after it added up, I was like, oh my God, for like 2 hours there, I could record a whole album somewhere else.
That's yeah. True. But you don't get the photo
yeah,
op.
That's right. You're not sitting inside Abbey Road making like, I thought with 2 hours, like what could I even get done? Like two acoustic guitar tracks? I don't even know how productive I'd be. But anyways, that's a tangent.
Before we move on, do you have any tips or recommendations on how to find a mastering engineer?
Yeah, I think the obvious place to start is to ask your mixing engineer or if that's a different person than the engineer who tracked the record, like ask those folks, because they usually will have a handful of people they trust and who've worked on material they've produced. So that right there, you know whether they trust this person to be a good fit or a bad fit. And presumably if it was a bad fit and a terrible experience, they would not even be giving you that mastering engineer's name. So that's the first place to start. Another place is just look at the credits or liner notes, if you can find them, of records you like. I guess particularly if they're by artists that are kind of in your same sphere or region or, you know, price range. Like if you're a hip hop artist, don't just assume you can get whoever mastered Kendrick Lamar's record, but you know, so album credits. Besides that, there's gotta be online discussion forums and stuff for this topic. Although I've never had to search there. Do you know, what do you usually do?
Well, I usually do the things you mentioned. I would say that it's important that you hear something that they've mastered before, because as we mentioned in this episode, all mastering engineers are not the same. Their approach to music is not the same, and the things they like to hear and the way they like to hear music isn't the same. So your outcomes will vary based on who you use. So if you're playing with artists in your local scene that have been recording and getting stuff mastered, you might ask them who they've used, how the experience was. Because one thing that we didn't mention is that revisions and the number of revisions they'll do is something that's important to ask. Because oftentimes you can get somebody great and it seems like, wow, I can't believe I can afford this person. And it's like, that's because they're going to say, here it is, no revisions. If I have to do a revision, it's going to cost you again. Where other people may be willing to do multiple revisions. It's pretty common for them to do like one revision where you're like, hey, I like this, but can you tweak this? And they'll run it again. Sometimes people will run it multiple times for you, but that's something that's worth asking.
That reminded me of something that I haven't dealt with in a while, but it's also really important to know whether this person works out of their own space or out of a studio that needs to be rented, like a mastering room, because if they have to go to a place that needs to be reserved and booked and paid for, that's really going to limit your ability to get revisions done. And it'll also, you know, potentially complicate things for your timeline. If you need a revision, suddenly you have to book the room again. I don't know how common that is anymore. I think a lot of mastering engineers at this point have their own kind of permanent space set up, but another thing to make sure of.
And a lot of mixing engineers will also do mastering, but most of the guys that we've had work on our albums for mixing, they tend to not like to be the person that masters it, which I think is a good call, that you should get somebody that didn't mix it to master it. I think that you're going to get better results that way. Somebody that mixed a bunch of our recent albums, great mixer. He does mastering as well, but he said, unless you're in a big, big pinch and just can't find anybody, I don't want to be the one to master it, because it's best to have a fresh set of ears, listen to it, and not still be thinking about the mix and just thinking about it from the mastering approach.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, from a few reasons, like perspective being one, getting fresh ears on it, but then also a different listening environment too. Like presumably a mixing engineer in one room mixed it to sound as good as they could. And then what are they going to do? Listen to the same thing in the same room and have the same, you know, and then suddenly be able to make it better. I mean, I know that's part of it. It's good to just get it into a different, different person, different room, different gear, fresh ears.
Plus, if you have the mixing engineer do it, they'll be thinking about, oh, I could go back and fix this in the mix and go back right to the mix. And it's like the mastering engineer knows that they've just got to work with what they've got and make it better from there. So I think that's something to consider. I know that this person that we used, I forget his name. He's in the UK. And the way we found out about him is he has a bunch of YouTube videos about mixing and mastering that are very popular. And the person that mixed our album or this latest single, he recommended him, saying, I watch all this guy's YouTube videos. He's amazing. He might have worked out of Abbey Road, but it's this collective that works somewhere else in the UK, a pretty popular studio. And I wish I'd written down his name. It was some like name like Sharky or Stinky. It was weird.
Yes, I'm now remembering. You told me about him. I looked him up and he seems like he's an interesting, super talented dude.
Yeah. And so his deal was, that's how we found him. And his deal was, you uploaded the track and you were supposed to have it within 48 hours. And it worked really quick and it was great. So people that have a big YouTube following that are audio engineers and mastering engineers might also have a portal where you can interface with them very quickly, no matter where they are in the world. And yeah, this guy had worked on like stuff for Adele and people like that. So he probably does it like what you're saying. It's like he gets these tracks uploaded. It's minimal work. He's not going to do a ton of back and forth, and he can pull it up in his spare time when he's not working on a major project and keep making money. And it worked out great. He's in the UK, so it was in pounds, but it turned out to be about $90 US.
Oh, it's not bad. Especially for, did you say you got it back in 48 hours?
Yeah, it was quick.
Cool. Mastering.
Well, if you have thoughts or comments about the mysterious process of mastering, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. The one thing we didn't mention is that you can master stuff yourself. There is software to do it, like mastering software. And some people just master inside of Pro Tools. So there are things you can do yourself. But I think turning it over to even automated software or a real mastering engineer is probably going to get you a lot better results.
It's a certainty in my case.
Same with me.
I would ruin whatever I had made.
Yeah, whenever I try to mix stuff just for like demo purposes, I feel like everything I do just makes everything worse. I'm like, how do people mix and make things sound better? I just feel like I'm making everything sound worse. So
it's because you just keep turning things up and up and up and up.
Just the guitars. I mean, that's what the people want.
Give them what they want.
They got to give them what they want.
Speaking of what people want, we want listener calls.
Yeah.
So you just gave a shout out to let us know your feedback. Please do, because there's no caller feedback today, right?
Correct. Well, you know what? We had a listener email in, Saral, who has emailed in before, a fantastic question about trademarking your band name. And in fact, one of the guys in my band has a new project that he was asking me the same question. And I sent the email out to a lawyer and I just got the response while we were recording this. But the way he formatted the email, he kind of answered everything in line. I don't want to stumble through it while we're recording because it'll be a mess. I want to have a chance to organize it so I can read through it in a more efficient manner on the podcast. But we do have that question that we will answer in an upcoming episode. So that's a good one. That's something that a lot of people have been asking. But yes, we went through a feast of calls and feedback that we couldn't even get to a bunch of them. and questions. And now it seems like we're in a bit of a dry spell. So please call, please email. And I do have one tweet. I think you'll find this humorous.
Oh, a tweet? Okay, I forgot. People can tweet us too.
So one of our listeners passed along this tweet, and I'll say who it is after I read the tweet. So this is from, the original tweet was from a music journalist for a heavy metal magazine, like online magazine. And he said, "Listen to a song sent to me today that I really like, but the band's name is so bad, I can't, won't promote them. This is the second time this has happened. Something worth considering if you're starting a band. Your name is important." And Jade from Band from Japan tweeted this at me and said, "Hey, Kevin, do you think it was us?" So if you heard the previous one of our previous episodes where we discussed this, and Band from Japan, that's their band name. We discussed their name, and it's B-A-N-N-E-D, band, as if kicked out from Japan. We discussed their name and whether or not it's confusing. So there's a music journalist giving feedback saying that it is important. It is something to consider, and choosing not to feature two different artists because they thought their band name was so bad.
Wow. I wish I knew what those names were.
I know. It's intriguing.
I guess we could write this person.
I don't know. He may not want to call them out.
It's true.
Because he liked the songs. But yeah, it's, to me, it goes back to one of the key things, and it's probably what this guy is alluding to, this music journalist, saying that if people feel stupid saying your name or uncomfortable because they don't know how to say your name, they're not going to want to say it. And that's a problem. And that's what's happening here with this journalist. He thinks it's stupid enough that he doesn't want to say it because he thinks it would look bad on his reputation or just feels bad. And I don't know who it is. Maybe this guy's being, you know, a goof
snob.
Himself. Yeah, a snob, a music snob. Who knows? But it's this just verifies that we know what we're talking about, Chris.
It does.
Our advice has validity.
Except for what's that website that
why I deleted your band's
why
email.
I deleted your press. Yeah, except to be self-deprecating for a moment, I did end up on that website.
Yeah. What you ended up on there for was borderline and questionable. Some people would like what you said. Other people would have the reaction like he did. Because I didn't think what he pulled out of for you was really should have had didn't have merit.
It didn't warrant the sting of being on that site.
No.
If anyone doesn't know about that site, go check it out. What's it called again? Why I deleted your press release?
I deleted your band promo email, I think is what it is. Something like that. Just Google those, you'll find it.
Pretty hilarious.
I don't know if it's kept up to date still, but it is pretty interesting. It's a good place to check in to make sure that you're not making the same mistakes when you contact press and all that. All right. Well, I think we've made it to the end, Chris.
All right. Hope everyone masters their music.
Go master your music and give us a call or an email. Your burning questions, your advice for other artists, your success stories, your mistake stories. We want them all.
I did just think of one last crucial bit of advice about mastering. If
what?
You use an online automated service, do not upload an MP3. Start with a high quality WAV file or whatever you got that's higher quality than MP3, because it's amazing how many people think that an MP3 is the finished product, and then try to distribute it through CD Baby to the world.
Yeah.
Save yourself the headache.
Yeah. And also, make sure you download a WAV file from an automated mastering service, because they will give you the option to download an MP3. So make sure you're getting a high quality mastered track that then becomes the basis for everything else you make. So if you need to convert something to an MP3 to promote your, to press or to put in an email or something like that, you use that high quality WAV file as the standard and create a high quality MP3 from that WAV file.
Now everyone knows what they need. We've done our job.
We have done our job. We can go now.
All right. We'll have a happy weekend.
All right. That's going to do it. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.